Sarah.
Hi, Allison. So I know this is a show about France, but we can't really ignore the American election, which was 2 days ago as we're recording this.
No, we can't. And Emmanuel Macron was among the first world leaders to congratulate Donald Trump on his win, just behind the likes of Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu and Hungary's Viktor Orban.
Right. Good company.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So Macron said on social media that he was, I quote, ready to work together as we did for 4 years, with your convictions and mine, with respect and ambition for greater peace and prosperity.
But then he gave a more coordinated and European response with German leader Olaf Scholz, stressing the challenges posed by Trump's America First protectionist trade policy and the isolationist rhetoric.
Yeah, Macron is in a rather fragile position now. His party lost parliamentary elections this summer, as we've mentioned before. And he's now in a coalition that's dominated really by the Conservatives and the far right. So he needs to be part of a stronger Europe to sort of shelve himself up. He said that Berlin and Paris would work for a united, stronger Europe within what he called the new context.
Yeah, and that new context involves, for example, Ukraine, which France has been at pains to defend against Russia's aggression. Trump, who's promised world peace in Ukraine and the Middle East within 24 hours of taking office, will likely insist on Ukraine negotiating a deal with Russia, which is a very different position from France.
Yeah, and on the economic front, perhaps France's major worry now is that, well, Trump is promising higher tariffs on French goods, and especially wine and spirits. The US remains France's biggest market for wine and cognac, for example, and French wine growers and makers of brand Andy already had a tough time during Trump's first term when he imposed a 25% increase in import taxes. That led to an estimated 40% drop in exports of wine, for example, to the US.
Yeah, perhaps unsurprisingly, France's far right are, on the whole, thrilled to see a populist return to the White House. Marion Maréchal, an MEP with the far right Reconquest Party, welcomed Trump's victory. She called him a hope for peace, a defeat for wokeism, and a pathway for right-wing parties in France and Europe.
But her aunt, Marine Le Pen, the famous leader of the far-right National Rally Party, was far more circumspect. She reacted to Trump's win, saying the only thing that mattered was French interests. Since the US will now defend even more vigorously their own interests, she said, Europe will have to wake up.
Since Le Pen's party won the most seats in the National Assembly, Le Pen has continued her quest for respectability. She's distanced herself and her party, in public at least, from populist leaders like Putin and Orban.
And the French overall, Sarah, are not big Trump fans.
Yeah.
Recent polls have shown that two-thirds of the French supported Kamala Harris, just 13% Donald Trump. And among National Rally supporters, only around a third wanted to see Trump return to power. So if Le Pen wants to become France's next president in 2026, as she has indicated, well, she has no vested interest in identifying too closely with Donald Trump.
Quand c'est l'air du plastique qui soudain s'en va en fumée, la mélodie la plus toxique que l'homme aurait pu inventer, cendres noires dans le ciel retrouveront leur paysage, la musique est partout la même, cette terre est juste de passage.
And now to trash. We produce a lot of it. Boxes and cartons from the stuff we buy, food containers.
Even in organic food packaged in supermarkets. There's so much packaging, it drives me crazy.
Yeah, yeah. And a big concern is single-use plastic. It contributes to ocean pollution. It generates a lot of waste. It's made with petroleum. A 2018 law in France has been progressively limiting single-use plastic sales in food. It banned plastic straws, plastic takeout containers. Last year, it moved to get rid of fruits and vegetables in grocery store of plastic packaging. Shipping and logistics is now the next target. France produces 2.2 million tons of plastic packaging a year. A 2021 law is intended to phase out single-use packaging by 2040 by encouraging recyclable or compostable materials. And the EU is more ambitious. It wants to get to 100% recyclable packaging by 2030. How exactly is this going to happen? Well, a big focus is on the companies that supply this stuff. They need to change what they make and what they sell, which is why I was interested in visiting a recent packaging expo here outside of Paris. It's not the most sexy place to be, but it was interesting to see those who are being pushed to the front lines of waste reduction. Packaging is ubiquitous, from the carton for your morning cereal to the box that your new shoes are shipped in. In France, what's more iconic than an éclair in a bakery?
Chez un artisan boulanger, donc on va avoir ce qu'on appelle la boîte pâtissière qui sert à mettre les gâteaux.
Frédéric Monge is showing boxes and trays intended for pastries. She's the sales manager for the Le Bar Group, a small French company that produces food packaging, mostly for bakeries. So there are boxes for cakes, bags to hold those boxes, but also the pieces of cardboards that the cakes or pastries sit on so they could be lifted without falling apart. And those are hard to make without plastic.
Parce qu'il fallait une protection au gras et à l'humidité.
You need a barrier against grease and humidity, she explains. When you buy a cake, you don't want grease stains on the pastry box. 3 years ago, the company came up with an all-paper alternative, as some customers were asking for it, but not everyone's interested.
Quand vous parlez de support pelliculé, souvent vous avez des matières qui sont couleur or, noir.
Plastic-lined cake boards are often colored, golden or shiny black, and the non-plastified versions are natural-colored, brown, she explains. It's less elegant. So bakers insist on having the shininess. Her company still provides them with the plastic-lined cartons. This is the difficulty with adapting to new packaging. It doesn't always act in the way you're used to. Many companies are, however, looking to shift anyway.
Vous avez des sociétés qui veulent ne plus avoir d'impact durable sur l'environnement.
François-Xavier Francais, the sales director for FDR, which makes compostable plastic wrap, says many of his clients are looking to reduce their environmental impact. His company started out 10 years ago making paper bags with compostable plastic display windows for organic stores, for them to sell their lentils or pastas, for example. But over the last 4 or 5 years, Francais says interest has expanded into the mainstream. The 2018 law in France, which has been phasing out single-use plastic used for food, last year banned plastic wrapping for fruits and vegetables in supermarkets. Companies have since been trying to find solutions for things like berries or mushrooms. Francais said he got a lot of calls in the months leading up to that ban.
On nous a appelé en urgence pour remplacer les films plastiques.
We got urgent calls to replace the plastic cling wrap. The laws have pushed that change. For Émilie Chéral, the general manager of EcoCert Green Life, which gives certifications for organic products, legislation is one important part of pushing companies to be more sustainable.
Regulation is one option because it will push the industry really to think about their model.
But she says customer demand is also important, though they want guarantees. It's not enough for a company just to say it's green. That's where certifications come in from companies like EcoCert.
Sustainability is on every mouth. Everybody's talking about sustainability. And this is why I think certification is so important, because today anybody can say anything about eco-responsibility, sustainability, any words. And what we do is really going on the field and making the traceability of all these materials. And this is a guarantee to the consumer that if it's certified, then you can make sure that the environmental impact is less.
She says packaging companies seem to be taking sustainability to heart.
I think that this sector is really moving right now, and probably moving because of the regulation. But even if the regulation is not coming next year, we see that companies are anticipating, so it's great.
Raja is France's and Europe's largest distributor of shipping materials.
So boxes, first of all, this is the heart of the company. You also have a stretch film, pallet, all the equipment for the warehouse, tapes. So the packaging world is very, very wide.
Dunya Kauti is the company's marketing manager. She says Raja has been long focused on reducing waste, even before the regulations. Today, the company advises clients on how to minimize the size of their packaging or eliminate parts of it altogether. For example, the company's developed paper bubble wrap or a thinner kind of stretch film.
It's only 3.8 micron, and the standard in the market is 8 micron. So when you reduce also the material of your product, you have a benefic impact. So you can still use plastic, but you use less.
Raphaël Baudère, the company's director of sales, says clients are asking specifically for sustainable solutions.
Today, the clients are aware about the carbon impact. They're doing already, in fact, their own work on that. So also sometimes when I met a few clients, they said for me, no plastic. I don't see any plastic. So only paper, yes. So it's coming more and more. And they are more aware about, not only about law, but because also about they are sensitive more and more about the environment and sensitive more and more about the carbon impact.
But of course, plastic is not going to disappear overnight. François-Xavier Francais of the FDR Compostable Plastic Company says his product has its limitations. The plastic alternative can replace most cling film, but not everything. Some things have no equivalent, he says, notably bags for endives, which are problematic. Endives, the bitter lettuce roots that are quite popular here in France, they're sold in sealed, opaque plastic bags to keep them fresh and protect them from the light. You realize how specific all of this stuff really is. And then there's the issue of price. Petroleum-based plastic remains much cheaper than the paper pulp used in this product.
Après, en fonction de la réglementation qui va arriver, des taxations sur certains matériaux.
With new regulations and taxes on some materials and the high cost of recycling, maybe it will reach a similar price, he says. But he's not holding his breath. Though Raphaël Baudère of Raja says some companies are willing to pay more for the ecological packaging.
Clients are ready to pay a bit more to have a like green package, you know, so that's important also for them. Said, I'm ready to pay 10% more or 15% more, but I need responsible green package.
So a lot of the regulations on waste reduction come from Europe, right, Sarah? Mm. Is France just following along because it has to?
Yeah. A lot of people I spoke to say that France is actually leading the charge in its way. France is a big agriculture producer, so food packaging really is a big issue. It has passed its own laws limiting plastic, which it seems has led to some confusion in terms of how those laws interact with the European regulations. But there really does seem to be a move towards sustainability, which isn't complete greenwashing.
That's the sound of Brittany, part of France that's famous for its music, its wonderful coastline, and its independent spirit. Now, 100 years ago, all of those things came together in a historic strike. And Jess Phelan is here to tell us a bit more about it. Hi, Jess.
Hello. Yeah, we're talking specifically about the port of Douarnenez on the Atlantic Ocean. Now, Alison, I know that you've been there. How would you describe it?
It's very pretty. A port town, cobbled streets in the town, striking views of the sea, a few tall ships in the harbour, and a shipping and a sardine museum, both of which are like a nod to its past. I picked up a tin of chocolate sardines on my recent trip.
Lovely.
Very nice.
Well, yeah, today it's a tourist destination, but a century ago it was a boom town. France had developed the process of canning, and suddenly it could sell its fish all over the world. And the ports of Brittany were where most of the sardines and other fish were tinned. And Douarnenez was one of the biggest. It had dozens of canning factories, and they were staffed almost entirely by women.
Which wasn't that common at the time.
Right, not in most industries, but men and boys would go out to catch the fish, and women and girls were hired to clean it, to fry it, and to can it.
That sounds like tough work.
Yeah.
A little goopy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, there's the job of cutting the heads off these raw sardines or throwing them into hot oil, packing them into tins. It must have absolutely stunk. And these women had to do it round the clock. This is Arlette Julien, who runs a local history association in Douarnenez and whose grandmother, Augustine, used to work in one of the canning factories.
There was no refrigerated storage like we have today. So when the sardines arrived, you had to go to work right away. In high season, in summer, that meant days that never ended. My aunt told me they'd see my grandmother practically passed out on a chair because she wouldn't even take the time to change. She'd rest a little or for 2 or 3 hours, and then there'd be a knock on the window pane to tell her it was time to go back.
So as you can tell, there weren't many workers' rights. The women didn't get paid overtime, and factories would employ girls as young as 9 or 10 years old. And until 1905, they only paid workers per 1,000 sardines tinned, which meant that it was really easy for them to shortchange their workers.
But that changed.
Yeah, so thanks to a strike. In February 1905, the sardine canners called their first strike in Douarnenez, which won them the right to be paid by the hour instead of by output. But they were still only getting 80 centimes an hour, which is a little less than the price of a litre of milk at the time. So in November 1924, they decided to ask for more. First at one cannery, and then within days it had spread throughout the entire town. Thousands of women came out into the streets every day and they would sing these protest songs. So, pain frais à la veau, that one roughly translates as we'll get 1.25 francs, which is what they were demanding to be paid per hour.
So how come they were so organised?
Well, the strike of 1905 had laid the foundations of a union movement. And in the meantime, the town had elected first one, then a second communist mayor, which were actually two of the first in France. And the mayor in charge at the time of the 1924 strike was called Daniel Le Flanchec, and he supported the strikers 100%. He helped get national unions involved, who sent their representatives to Douarnenez to spur these women on. Arlette remembers her grandmother telling her about one union rep in particular called Lucie Colliard, who later wrote a book about the strike. And Arlette says she really helped change the way her own grandmother saw the world.
C'est quelqu'un que j'ai toujours connu avec une liberté dans le discours.
I always knew her as someone who spoke freely, who had a desire for dignity, to go forward, to follow the news, form opinions, and so on. From what she described, I got a sense of how much she'd learned, because there was a time when she just went to work and that was it. She told me about this activist at the time called Lucie Colliard, who began to explain the economic aspect, to say, you earn such and such while the boss makes this much, things she hadn't necessarily realised before. So it was also a time to learn, in fact.
So Arlette's grandma, Augustine, was 38 years old at the time, and she had four children. And she would help spread the message about the strike to older women who only spoke Breton, not French. And she was part of a committee that handed out food to striking workers to help them hold out. And they collected donations from local farms, and people were also sending money from all over France, even abroad, which meant that they managed to keep the strike going for 46 days in total.
Wow, a month and a half. That's impressive. Mm-hmm. How did it all end?
Well, after the women had stayed basically nonviolent all that time, on the 1st of January 1925, a fight broke out between men. By that point, fishermen had joined in and they weren't going out to sea, and the factory bosses had hired male strikebreakers to come in. They got into a brawl at a local cafe and the mayor, Le Flanchec, was shot. He survived, but it triggered a riot, at which point the regional prefect stepped in and ordered the factory owners to negotiate. So 5 days later, they agreed to raise the women's wages to 1 franc an hour, to pay extra for working past midnight, and to recognise the right to unionise.
But they didn't get the 1.25 francs they'd been asking for.
Mm-hmm, right. But Arlette believes the strike mainly showed the women that they could make demands.
I think aside from the result, because they got a small raise, not everything they asked for, but a bit. Afterwards, the unions were established and they got used to the idea of saying to themselves, we can still do better. I heard my grandma say, we learned that we were citizens. It was a kind of empowerment to say, we're going to take matters into our own hands.
And that lesson still resonates all these years later. In 2005, a musician and activist from Brittany called Claude Michel wrote a song about the sardine canners called Peine Sardine, which is what the women were nicknamed. It basically means sardine head in Breton. So the lyrics are about these women and girls standing up for themselves and winning. And now you hear it sung at protests all over France.
une sardine.
So let's pursue the fishy theme and stay in the Brittany region, but move into the present, Sarah, to look at a standoff between mussel farmers and people fishing spider crabs for a living.
Spider crabs, I believe, are a delicacy.
Yeah, and a protected species. Ah. The problem is they prey on mussels, among other seafoods, and they're having a devastating impact on mussel farms in the Gulf between Brittany and Normandy. Local businesses are reporting losses of millions of euros, and mussel farmers say they just can't go on, and they're calling on the authorities for urgent help. Our colleague Amanda Morrow has been looking into the story and joins us now. Amanda, first of all, just tell us a bit more about these Breton mussels.
Right, well, they're a special variety. They're called Bouchot mussels, and they're very tender with a sweet, distinct flavour. And they were first introduced to Brittany in the 1960s, grown in shallow bays fed by waters from the Atlantic, which are very rich in nutrients. Now, these type of mussels are grown on wooden stakes that are submerged during high tide, and then they're exposed at low tide. I don't know if you've seen the pictures.
No, I've seen them in real life as well, these sticks sticking out of the water. So people like to eat these bouchot. I do, but so do other creatures.
That's right, especially spider crabs. Now, they are native to the waters around Brittany. They're also a delicacy themselves, known for their meat, which is also sweet, also a bit chewy. They love to eat the mussels, and that's obviously been a problem for mussel farmers, especially because the population of spider crabs has exploded four times over the past decade. And this season, farmers in the bays of Saint-Brieuc and Fresnay say that spider crabs have eaten the majority of their crop. So I spoke to Cédric Serrandour. He's a farmer whose family business, Les Merveilles du Cap, has been growing these bouchot mussels and also hollow oysters in the Bay of Fresnay for four generations. He says that over the past 5 years, he's lost about 500 tons of mussels. And now this summer, juvenile spider crabs devoured his crop of baby mussels too.
We saw spider crabs arriving as early as April this year, so very early in the season, and we had a very long period of predation. We realized they had eaten 80% of our baby mussels in just 4 days. If we don't have any baby mussels for the next season, it'll be a disaster. We're talking about losing an entire season, and there'll be very little production for 2025.
So there's this kind of invading animal attacking his crop. It's a bit like locusts or something like that, right? Can he catch them? Can he kill them?
No, he can't, because spider crabs are actually protected under the Berne Convention, which protects European wildlife. So that means there are limits to how many crabs can be caught and destroyed. And the crabs themselves, Alison, they're actually an increasingly profitable resource for seafood markets across Europe. This is because now they provide a steady income for other fishermen who can catch them outside of their traditional fishing season. And the French Research Institute for the Exploitation of the Sea, IFREMER, has been studying the crabs and tasked with working out why there are now so many of them. Biologist Marshall Laurent told me that one obvious factor is warmer waters.
The spider crabs need a temperature around 15 or 16 degrees to begin the reproduction. And in some area, the period where the temperature is good is quite large today. So the reproduction period can be larger.
So we have this situation where there are more spider crabs because of warmer waters, probably connected to climate change. And this is good for some fishermen, but it's not at all good for mussel farmers. So it's a kind of standoff, really.
Yeah, that's right. Mussel farmers have permission to catch the crabs and then release them offshore, but that's had little impact. IFRAMET has been looking at other ways, other technologies to keep the crabs away from the mussels. And they actually, last year, they tested a method using sound because spider crabs are very sensitive to noise. They attached chains to trawlers and generated this type of vibrations to try and scare the crabs away from the mussel farm. And while it did drive a lot of the crabs away, it has not eliminated the problem at all. And Laurence says that mussel farmers, they now need to work together with the crab fishermen to try and find a solution.
Mussel producers, they are not allowed to destroy spider crab because it's really a resource for the fishermen. They are not fishermen, so they don't have a license. So they have to work with fishermen to try to decrease the number of spider crab close to their concessions.
Yeah, so it's going to involve kind of teamwork, isn't it? How is that working out so far?
Well, the mussel producers are saying it's not working out at all. They say that they simply won't survive if radical measures aren't taken. And Serrando says that they should be allowed to more aggressively control any spider crabs that come near their farming zones.
We're calling for the species to be regulated to avoid this happening again in the future. We want spider crabs to be classified as pests. And we're also asking for direct financial support, just like the farmers received earlier this year.
So Serrandor and other mussel farmers say that without financial support, their industry is going to collapse altogether.
Thanks, Amanda. Alas, it's not the best time to be asking the French government for any kind of financial support. There's a lot of belt tightening going on at the moment as the government tries to trim its budget for 2025. It has to save 60 billion euros to mop up the deficit. The mussel farmers' dilemma highlights once more the difficult trade-offs between intervening to cull an invasive species or letting nature run its course. Though, if the root cause of the spread of predatory spider crabs is climate change, then the problem isn't going to sort itself out anytime soon. J'ai mis un crâne dans le bocal où mes deux poissons s'ennuyaient. That's it for the show. Spotlight on France is a production of Radio France International, and this episode was mixed by Cécile Pompiani.
You can find us and subscribe on Spotify or Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Please consider rating and reviewing us. We'd love to hear what you think. If you want to send us a message, write to us at spotlight.france@rfi.fr. We're also on Instagram at Spotlight on France.
We'll be back in 2 weeks' time on Thursday, November the 21st. Bye-bye, Sarah.
Bye, Alison. Et si un jour je me lassais,